Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Nature Connection Show with Lisa and Nancy, publishers of Big Blend magazines, and nature photographer Margot Carrera. Hey, everybody, welcome. We are very excited to welcome two authors joining us to talk about their book, The Conceivable Future: Planning Families and Taking Action in the Age of Climate Change. Yeah, that's kind of a real deal, man. It's, you can't mess around. So we've got Megan Elizabeth Coleman joining us and Josephine Ferrarelli, and I hope I pronounced her name right. And the foreword of the book is by Elizabeth Rush. Check it out. It comes out February 2024 through Roman and Littlefield, but you can get it now. You can also go to their website for their organization, conceivablefuture.org. So welcome, ladies. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for having us.
Okay, so good to have you both on the show. And I want to start with you, Josephine. How did you meet Megan? How did this all start? Because you're both two different states, right?
It's true. I met Megan by chance through a mutual friend in November of 2014. So we're almost, this is an anniversary of sorts.
Yeah.
And it was the funniest thing. We have a friend named Jamie Topper, who's a musician, and I was visiting, my partner and I were visiting Jamie because Jamie was going to play this show, of music she had composed, to accompany a lecture on dark matter that a physicist was giving.
Oh, cool. That's my style of thing, right? I'm in.
Oh, you would have loved it. It was phenomenal. And before the show started, Jamie kind of grabbed me and dragged me over to Megan and was like, you two are climate people. You should talk. And I don't know exactly, like, I don't know if this would have happened at another time in my life. There was just something about where I was at, where Megan was at, was within the first 5 or 10 minutes that we were talking about what a scary time it is to consider starting a family. Right. And just that deep connection between the personal and the political that we really I hadn't had that conversation, but I had that thought for like most of my life. So it was a really important conversation. It was a really important meeting in my life.
Yeah. I think it's really important to talk about children coming onto the planet, period, because some of our human rights as women are being taken away at the same time. So it's kind of a really trippy, weird time. It's weird. It's a weird time. Not necessarily positive time for women, but there's a fear, I think, a big fear. And, you know, before we started recording, I was talking about, like, I chose not to have kids at a very young age. But it doesn't mean that it would stick that way. And who knows? Anything could change, right? And that's fine. You know, I'm fine with that, but I chose it for my lifestyle and because I thought, you know, there are people that really want kids on this planet and they want them. And everything I do is really for the generation of the future for what I work. So it's not anti-kid. So I think there's people like me, but then there's people like me that are just also terrified of having kids now. What do you say, Megan, about that, about people?
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think in order to answer that question, I'm going to backpedal a little bit.
Look, she went into the dark.
I went dark.
She went in the dark.
I wasn't being moving active enough. So when Josephine and I met, as she said, we were both 30 years old and we were this question was starting to sort of press on us. And what we found, among other things, was that there was a real dearth of spaces where people could talk about like what it means to think about a family in a really unstable future. And that inquiry led us down a like 10-year organizing project. So we built an organization called it Conceivable Future. And at the outset, really all we were focused on doing was bringing people together to have conversations about what climate change meant to their reproductive lives. That was it. So our spaces have always been open to parents, to non-parents, to undecided, to anybody who falls anywhere in the spectrum of loving the next generation, right? Whether that's through being a parent, through being an aunt or an uncle, through being a teacher. And it was simply to hold some non-judgmental space where people didn't feel like they were going to be bossed around or judged for whatever fears they brought forward.
Thank you, because you didn't judge me, because normally if I had said anything, about exactly, I rarely say it, that
And
was, and
that
it's rare.
taboo, I
That
think, was pressing very heavily on a lot of people because, I mean, and there's a lot of reasons for it, right? So, as the organization sort of we built out and we grew, we initially followed this model of house parties that we actually sort of filched from second wave feminism organizing. And the idea was just that bringing people together and giving them some space and a little bit of a safe framework to have some conversations helps create a political critique, right? Helps create a sense of belonging in a broader movement, helps us feel less alone. And the goal here has always been to empower people to take political action to slow, staunch the bleeding, right? To slow climate change, to adapt better, to make the world more just, right? So the feelings about parenting are kind of the entry point. They're the door through which we walk, in order to get activated in all these other spaces in our lives. And as we were doing all of this work, right, we found that we had to, by default, engage in a whole lot of conversations that had been kind of like messily circling this topic. Chief among them was population, right? So there's, we're pretty critical of the population arguments or the zero growth population movements, because the data has shown over and over and over again, that those policies target poor women, target women of color, target women in the global South. And that, like, truly, a justice-based in approach is not about
That's
curtailing human
interesting.
rights.
Can I just say, because I was raised in Africa. And so I wonder if that was how I got hold of that information, because
I think
I was raised
probably.
in Kenya and South Africa, and it was South Africa. I was in my more becoming an adult teenager kind of thing at that point.
I think you would have received it here too, but I suspect that it has a different. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what kind of
Because everyone's
messaging you
like,
were
oh, they're
receiving.
starving Africans, which there are, but there's that. And you always heard about that over time. Megan's coming back, but yeah, so you always she's in the dark, she's in the light, she's coming through. It's all
Right.
good,
I'll just stay dark. Okay.
but no, it's a whatever. It's kind of interesting going from South Africa as a teenager, then coming here when I was 19, and it was a culture shock for me. And so yes, there are starving people all over the world, India, China, everywhere, right? So don't, but I don't know how I got hold of that information, and I have lived it with tribes in the woods and not
Well, in
in
this
the
country
woods.
as well, there was a
So
huge effort to, by groups like Zero Population Growth, to mainstream the idea that more people equals more environmental harm in like elementary school, middle school science curricula. So
okay.
we were getting it in this country as well. The critical piece that's missing there is that population correlates with environmental harm only to the degree that it correlates with consumption, right? So,
Right.
in this country, the population is not really growing. We keep on hearing headlines about how the population is actually at an all-time
Yeah, we stopped
population
having
growth is at
kids because
all-time
we
low.
don't need to do that many farm kids anymore, right?
All that stuff. But at the
Yeah.
same time, our consumption is huge, right? Like our per capita consumption is huge.
Okay.
So then it's, I mean, you could look at that and say, well, maybe we should have fewer people, but that seems like a very convoluted way to approach the problem. It's like, why is consumption built in? Why is waste built in? Why is fossil fuels emissions built in at such a high level just to live in this country? You know from your experiences of living other places that it doesn't, none
No,
of this is
we live
equivalent to
different.
like a
We used
happy, good
no
quality of life.
that
You
that.
don't need, yeah, sorry, go
No,
ahead.
this country is huge in consumption. That was the culture shock. When we got here, it was like 30 years ago, and we went to a grocery store. My mom and I, she grew up here, and I left when I was a year and a half and lived in the bush in Kenya. We went to England, culture shock for a year and a half, and had to go back to Africa. just no offense to England. England's cool. So South Africa, and then it was time to come home during a lot of political unrest, and being American citizens, you needed to. And we went to a grocery store, and I remember standing there looking at my mom going, why are there 10 butters? What was wrong with the first butter? And last year, my best friend from South Africa, high school friend, came over. We haven't, it was very hard for all of us to find each other, and we did. And she came over, And I took her to a grocery store, and lo and behold, it was the butter aisle and the same thing. She goes, "What's wrong with your butter?" And I said, "Well, now I know." I didn't know back then because it was in the early 90s. We didn't know. Now, yeah, now everybody knows I'm old. But, so it was this whole thing. And it is true about the consumption. How many plastic containers of margarine, which is already plastic, do we need? How many of these things? And so you both, with what your book is about, bring hope and light. And I have a friend who's an environmentalist who went to college for the whole thing. And he looked at me one day and said, "Lisa, you're into the environment. You've got a brain. You're the people we want to have multiply." And I said, "That's a really terrible thing to say." That is, it's a terrible thing to say.
We've heard that quite a lot, and our response is also the same. And it's just like, that is a, it's a thin veneer over classism and racism. I mean, for us, the only right answer, we call this the impossible question, right? This question of whether or not, how do I parent? It's an impossible question when there's only challenging structural inequalities facing you, right? So the only right answer to the impossible question, as far as we're concerned, is to whatever your decisions or life circumstances about parenting is to work as hard as we can for a world that's safe for everyone's kids. That's it. Doesn't matter if I
Period.
have
I agree.
kids, Josephine has none, right? So it doesn't matter. It should, for us, it doesn't matter whose kids they are. Every kid deserves to be born into a world that can
Yeah.
sustain them. And
I
that's
care
our job.
about all my friends' kids, their family. I mean, they're all family. And it's like, do you, we go to park. I mean, we document parks and public lands, and we go to a park. You see a kid in awe over something. How do you not be touched by that? How do you not be touched about our fellow human beings and their kids? And you want them to have this chance. And it's really, I think what you're doing is very interesting because it's a way to actually call action, no matter what your political beliefs are, no matter what your race is, no matter what background, how rich, poor, what, it doesn't matter. That is what the climate change action is. But calling parents is important, and for others to know that you're not alone.
And that was the
Yeah.
key
And there's
thing,
a,
right? Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, there's a particular feminist problem in here as well. And Lisa, I'm sure that you've had this experience that if you share that you are not a parent, and especially if you share that environmental reasons play a role, people often receive that as if it's a judgment on them. And there's a way in which for women specifically, but like it for people more broadly, like there's not enough room for people to make their own decisions and to be supported in that for reproductive decisions specifically. It's always like someone else knows what the right answer, but there's no way that
Dude,
you
at the
do
end of the
this.
day, I don't even want to go through the pain, okay? So, like, I don't
Right,
want to go
yeah.
through childbirth. That's also another reason.
Right. And those are
That's
completely
honest,
valid
but
and they
I will
don't
go through it. I'd
invalidate
go through it.
someone else's. So it's like, how do we all benefit when there's space for all of us, right? When you can live how you want to live and make decisions that are right for you without, first of all, without massive avoidable government-sponsored harm in the form of the climate crisis. But secondly, without this feeling, this pressure to conform to like a certain gendered norm that being a parent or being a
Oh,
mother
yeah.
is like the only like fulfillment, the ultimate fulfillment, and you'll never know what you're missing until that there's these strong pressures.
Oh, or I'm gay. If I didn't
Right.
have a child, you're gay. And that's not true. And if I've had people, because my mom and I travel together, ask us, how long have you been together? And I said, well, I know her inside and out since like a kid. But, so just because you get to make these decisions, and when we came to the States, I thought in South Africa, you can't really make that time as many decisions. And over here, coming home, and I was like, this is my decision at this time. If it wants to change, it can, and it hasn't. I'm a traveler and I do what I do. It's a work thing too, but it's like, if you want to have a child, you can at any time.
Yeah,
But
and I think, the other piece of this is that even for, women in the States, the ability to like make these choices freely doesn't really exist, right? Like we, in some places, the right to you know, contraceptive access and abortion is protected. In some places, it's not. But in some places, right. even if it's protected, you can't access it, right? Because it's too far away, or the closest clinic is a 9-hour bus ride, or your insurance is giving you a hard time, or whatever. You're stuck in an abusive relationship, right? So I mean, I think once you start pulling on this thread of reproduction, you get to all of these other pieces that support healthy environments and lives, sort of broadly defined and for everybody, right? So for us, you know, climate health involves reproductive health, reproductive sovereignty, the right to live in an environment that's not polluted, the right to like know what a tree looks like and have access to it. Exactly. Healthcare, food. So you know, access to things, transportation, right? So one of the things that we discovered as we started this organization and, you know, started hearing from people is that there's all these different bits that came into it. So for instance, one of the things that we heard a lot at the very beginning was like people saying, well, I don't have children, or if I don't have children, how do I pass on my gifts to the next generation? And particularly in the US middle class, it's a very class-based thing, but like in the US middle class, it's, you know, the nuclear family is kind of the ideal. And if you don't have kids, you don't really have access to kids, right? So you can't, you know, where do you put the donut recipe or like your grandmother's copy of the book or whatever it is? Like, how do you pass those along? And so part of that is, you know, we have a pretty impoverished view in my perspective of what a family is, right? That it's very rigidly defined, and that it's not acknowledged politically or legally as, you know, like expansive. And so we have, you know, there are all sorts of ways that can support human thriving that we've made it very difficult to support human thriving. So that was, you know, the how do I have children in my life if I don't, quote, have them myself? That was one thing that we heard. Another thing that we hear a lot is, you know, all of my activist time is like eaten up by parenting. So say I have two toddlers, so I got twin toddlers, and bedtime and community meeting time is the same time, and there's no babysitter and there's no food, and we get home from work and we're smoked and the kids are smoked. Everybody's tired. Like, how do I maintain activist connections while I'm also parenting? So once we started having these conversations and just sort of said to folks, bring your experience in, tell us what's on your mind. We heard a huge range of things, a huge range, right? So we certainly heard like fear about what kind of worlds children would inhabit, like a hotter and violent and less stable and more dangerous world where shortage in human conflict characterizes more interactions than they do currently. But also that the climate change crisis exposes and like exacerbates, it lands on a landscape that's already really unequal, right? So unequal in terms of racial privilege and racial oppression, unequal in terms of gender privilege and gender oppression. In fact, the same week that we got our book contract, the Supreme Court issued the Dobbs decision, and it gutted the EPA's right to like enforce climate standards, right? So it was the same week that we got this book, and we're like, oh, okay, so now we're writing about a really different environment than we were writing about. Yeah. And well, so when we put this conversation down, it lands on like a surface that's already patterned by all these historical inequalities, you know? And so one of the things we've done over time is like try to really peel apart some of these layers and see what else is feeding this. Sorry, Josephine, did I?
I want to go with this being a very global thing. And so from the American side, but it's global, right? Climate change is huge, and there is major fear. And what I talk about on shows a lot is people are worried about immigrants coming into our country and things like that. And I said, well, get used to it, and get used to you may have to pack your bags. I did an interview with a lady who wrote about a remote area in Alaska that she was in her early years, and she's pretty much an elder now. And I said, well, this island, like, what's it like now with climate change? She said, first island to leave, to pack up. And it's going away. So we really, I mean, the climate, you know, people in islands and places like that, that we want to go vacation and go have our little Bahama mama, this is going to change. And we can go on our wonderful cruise lines, cruising cities, and go have these cocktails and go have these big vacations. But at the end of the day, it's about us, I believe, having this conversation with our kids in our lives, whether you're a parent, whether you're a foster parent, where you're adopting, you know, it really doesn't matter. You know, like for me, I said, my friends are having the kids, because most of my friends, everybody was getting engaged and married at the time we left high school. And I was like, no. But I'm supporting them in whatever they need to do. You know, you become the aunt, you become that. And it's about working together and not ignoring it. And don't hide the fear factor, because the fear factor is real. And I bring up the Africa thing because the fear factor was real growing up. I went through a lot of crazy stuff. But I also had this immense beauty that I was in my backyard, right? I learned about snakes, and I should be dead now by like the amount of snake encounters. However, I was taught how to react, how to deal with things. And that's where I want to go with your book, is that in your organization, these conversations are so important, right? Because that's like you're saying, you're getting all this information. What are people's fears? How can we fix things? And what do people really need, no matter what?
Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of getting together, and you can't hide the truth. You can't.
Yeah.
And the inequalities are there in every country. I mean, when we came to this country, you know, abortion was legal. Now it's not, you know, so it's like, and in South Africa, abortion was illegal. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of up and down,
yeah.
But the reality is raising kids to maybe not be so phone fixated, even though they know how to use it and get information, but actually use it in the correct ways, be part of something so it's not as scary, but making the positive changes that need to happen. Does that make sense?
For sure. Yeah. I think that, like, there's also, because we didn't grow up with it, I think there's a tendency to only see the downside to the technology because we know we can do without. But the thing that I really love about kids' use of technology now is that they're doing what you're describing. Like, I feel like I watch kids interact with each other in a way that's like sort of seamlessly digital and real. And it just feels like they're always feeling each other's heartbeats in a certain way.
Well, that's a good way. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I know not, it's like everything. It has, people are not all getting a great experience, but you were talking about stepping in to be with your, the children of your friends, the like making these kinship relationships. And I think for Megan and I, that's really, we've come to see that as a form of activism, which is that it's another way of like knitting us closer together, becoming dependable in a meaningful way, making family where maybe there's not like a blood tie, but there's a love tie, because everybody's going to need it. Like, some parents might be so like up to their eyebrows in like responsibility and diapers that they don't identify like how economic inequality or how climate is a driver, whatever. They don't necessarily take it on the political level. It's just a personal experience. But you stepping in there, you having the kind of bandwidth, the capacity to like not just help in the nuts and bolts way, but help them make sense of that. That's a really huge role that a lot of us play for each other. And if we can do it intentionally.
It's community, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Aren't 100%. We like really looking at the conceivable future is about regrouping the village. And Africa has the villages,
you know,
right? That's
there's
it.
The second half of our book is based on that. And, you know, it starts, the first part of the book is sort of a tour through the history of women and gender-led movements and our own movement and kind of what we've learned around, you know, reproductive histories, autonomy, the reproductive justice movement, the population control movement, all sorts of stuff. And the second half is about how we become bigger than the challenges that we face, right? And the answer is always get together. It's always do things with each other. It's always build out your community, learn to show up for each other in ways that maybe we haven't, or maybe that just need to be strengthened. But to your earlier point about not hiding the ugly, we spoke to a number of child psychologists as a part of this project, and they all said the same thing, which is that kids, what did she say? She said, kids know when you're talking bullshit. Right.
Yep,
and so her
and
her assessment was like, look, the impulse is frequently to hide bad news from children, but children are not dupes, right? They understand if there's something very grave going on. And then if you pretend it away, then you become untrustworthy. And kids need their adults to be trustworthy. And therefore, like the way to handle this, in much the same way that they're the way to handle other threats, right? Other scary things that grownups don't have control over, is to be really truthful in an age appropriate way and teach kids how to build their own agency and their own autonomy and get them involved in stuff, right? So whether that's, you know, a tree planting thing at the community or the community park, or you take them to the state house and they learn how to, you know, testify for something or whatever, a letter writing campaign.
Pollinator gardens,
right?
Those are easy. Yeah.
But action is better than no action, right? And so, and that what helps, and this is, you know, coming from the nascent field of climate anxiety research, right, is that the antidote to that is climate action. And so we need to be teaching each other that, you know, Josephine and I were both born in the 80s. It was a kind of a weird time as far as political movements were concerned, right? There was we were teenagers, came of age in the go-go 90s, and there, you know, the sense of collective was not super present, in part because of the way the economy was. And I think that the kids who are young adults now, right, people my students age 18 to 22 or whatever, like they've come up in a very different environment. And in some ways they have way more skills at that age than
look at what they have done. I mean, yeah, for climate change, going against gun violence. I mean, they're exactly badasses. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And they
really are.
And they've had to develop that, unfortunately, because their adults have not handed them a safe world. They develop it, they have. And right, so part of this is building up those community organizing muscles and basically those community care muscles. The other thing I will say though about that is that often around climate, we have seen over the years many, many, many times is that there's all sorts of like really challenging intergenerational stickiness, right? So there's guilt and a feeling of being misunderstood, and there's a feeling of shame and, you know, finger pointing. And this is a rift that needs healing on all sides. And so we do, you know, we talk a lot to climate communications folks, again, psychologists, about how those conversations can be more constructive, because, you know, we have often heard from like people in their 20s, you know, if they're questioning their dreams of a family for one reason or another, you know, they get some scolding or some incredulity from their parents, which is not typically a super helpful response. And sort of similarly, people feel, you know, if you're an elder and you're feeling very responsible or sort of blamed, and there's no space to like air all the complexities. And so again, the advice that we get over and over from the communications experts, from the psychologists, is listen with curiosity, right? Just try to understand where the other person is coming from. You're going to have some feelings and you can save those.
No, I remember this. I remember this, you know, so Nancy, my mom is, you know, hosts the shows usually. And we did a live broadcast back in the old school days of us doing live broadcasts. And we were calling Monsanto and things like we were doing stuff in the White House and teaching people how to vote, all kinds of stupid things that we thought were, well, they did help. But, and the one guy we trusted who's like, well, you have to say this politically, he was a political guy, sat down next to my mom and said, you know, this is your fault, the way the world is. And it was like, what? I mean, her whole life has been animal conservation, saving tracts of land, and been out in all levels, speaking in the field, you name it, all of it. And she goes, what the hell? He goes, well, you and your damn hippies did this. And this is a Democrat young dude, right? And she looked at him and she's like, well, you can leave my house now. And he's like, no, I'm not done. And she goes, oh, you can leave now. It was so bad. It was absolutely not necessary, and he came off the way he shouldn't have. Yet they could have actually had a good conversation of how things happened, but he had just learned something and decided to attack her on it, right? And it was way off centered, you know. And you should know people a little bit better before you do it, and you never know who, what, and where. And right. So I think it's interesting about what you're saying about everybody has to have their, you can't just blame one person or a whole, it just isn't, it's complicated. I think it's that's a good word to use.
Yeah, it's a great word. It's a little bit like, it's, you're going to the grocery store in the US, like the fact that there's 10 kinds of butter is also not your fault, right? Like the system is being driven by forces much bigger than any of us individually. Yes. And so
I won't call Monsanto again. That's trouble.
Well, I think the other piece is though, we need everybody. We need everybody. Yeah. In order to move the needle on these things, right? So that means we need people who are nearing the end of their lives.
We have
need
to cross
the beginning
aisle.
Of their lives.
Everybody has to cross the aisles and get over it because, listen, division is definitely not working for anybody anywhere in this world right now.
Sure. And the thing that comes from like building that accountability is then people can like hold space for the complexity, right? Like, I'm sure also that your mom can see like around her, like her age cohort, like she was betrayed by them as well. Like there is this issue that like the people who are making decisions for this really consequential period of time, the people in power were not voting for the health and safety of the next generation.
Yeah,
they were voting for
Nixon,
like
who signed in the EPA, but whatever.
But yeah, breaking it down by like by age, like it makes a certain kind of logic when you're really angry, and it's much more complicated than that. So I think that like when you're in community, when you're with people you trust, you like you can hold the space for someone else's like bag of emotions. It's just that there's a lot of anger because there's a lot of injustice. And so like when young people, I think for us, the connection was, however angry we might feel at like the leadership that was like the generation before us, think about how our kids are going to feel, you know, toward us.
And how mad we get when there's leadership we don't like.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this, like, we need to kind of like relink that generational chain where there is a sense of accountability in all directions and also like a deep sense of love and responsibility.
Well,
so it's
yeah,
it's it, not that it, yeah.
It's huge because it's also led to grandparents and grandkids being separated. We've done shows on this, whereas like these generational gaps and finger pointing and political changes have led actual families to split, generations to be split, grandkids not knowing their grandparents. It's kind of ridiculous. And as the world, which is climate change, that is our alien that we're supposed to fight against, right? Climate change is here. We need to regroup and form that community to go, okay, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, we're in Tucson and it's 90 degrees in November. Not normally. We used to live here. We have our storage unit here. No, it's not normally 90 degrees in November, but it's sunny and warm, but maybe 70, 80s, not 90, not over 90. That's a little odd.
Yeah.
You know, so whether you believe, whatever your political beliefs are, the reality is kind of happening. Wildfires, hurricanes, earthquakes,
and again, the
most significant,
the like most direct path into that empathy is often just questions, right? Like starting with something that you share with someone that you love, and then asking some questions. So we talked to a guy named Matthew Goldberg, who's a climate scientist at the Yale Center for Climate Communications. He's a communications guy. I mean, he gave the example, if he had spoken with his neighbor about solar panels, and he was like, hey, how do you like your solar panels? And the guy was like, I don't give a dang about climate change. They're cheaper on my bill. And he was like, all right, great. So they had this shared moment of like, everybody had solar panels and the things that drew them to solar panels were different, but equally valid. And they both got there, right? And so the conversation was able to sort of take off and continue.
You can't be screaming down the street going, climate change is coming. You know, everybody be vegan right now. It's not going to happen.
Well, you have to think about, when has your mind ever been changed about anything? When have you ever been reached by any piece of information that you weren't inclined to accept? And it's almost, I doubt you would ever have one memory of being yelled at until you changed your mind about something, right?
Good point. What about schools and things like that, and kids going to schools and being taught things? How was that? Because I'm out of the loop on that.
Well, I think this is an interesting one. My mom is an environmental scientist, and she's taught biology for my whole life. And she actually chose her career in the early 80s, right, when global warming was becoming a thing that people talked about. And she said, oh, crap, like, you know, we better get on this. You know, and education is obviously hugely important. I guess what I would say, and I'm speaking a little bit from my role as a sociologist, is that, you know, education unto itself doesn't always produce like political transformation. So that's thing one, right? Like, people have to know, they have to have skills, civic or political or community organizing skills, to push on institutions. So that's obviously really important. Just knowing climate change is a problem can be paralyzing if you don't know how to engage yourself with other groups to figure out how to lessen it or alleviate some of the worst consequences. So that's thing one, right? Like, so that they're, you know, education about the science is necessary but insufficient. But the second thing, and I think this is probably more important, is that most kids who are alive today, you know, we have a 10-year rapidly closing window of time to avert catastrophic climate change, which means that, like, if the six-year-old, if we're pinning our hopes on the six-year-old, you know, we're in deep doo-doo, because the window for us to take this action will be closed by the time that child is 16, right? So this is an adult responsibility right now, as far as getting our system off fossil fuels, cleaning it up, making it more just, you know, creating a world in which the benefits and the harms of the climate transformation are, you know, distributed equitably. That's a grown-up job. And so, yes, we ought to be teaching, you know, climate science, environmental science, you know, science generally speaking. We also ought to be teaching civics and political efficacy. But really what we ought to be doing is solving this problem now, in the time that we have, to do it as well as we can. And so that, I think, you know, we hear a lot of like, well, maybe, you know, the kids coming up, they're going to save us with that. No, like, oh, the no, opportunity no, to no, save no. ourselves is right now.
We shouldn't be, oh, build it, you know, the children are our future. Sorry, Whitney Houston, but we are their future.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, and we are the future, not them. And we should be leaving it more pristine than what we had it. And that's the role of each generation. And so not going generationally, but it's kind of like a personal thing that, you know, keep your house clean for the next person that comes in, you know?
I think, though, so in the early years, for the first couple of years that we were organizing, I feel like we asked almost everybody that we talked to how they first heard about climate change. And I was actually surprised. Almost everyone said it was in school. Almost everybody.
Oh, really? Wow.
I mean, I have a really vivid memory of reading about global warming in an Archie comic. And that was like a really traumatic event for me as a child.
No way. Doug,
and then I did a little bit of research, and it turns out that Archie's been on the, you know, on the environmental tip for a really long time. It's kind of amazing. But it turns out, like, science classrooms is where this has been happening all along. I think Megan is right that, like, civics is maybe where the stumbling block is, which is like, yeah, you can know the crisis encyclopedically, but if you don't know how to make yourself a part of the solution, that is, how to work with other people and have your reach to the bigger levers, like, it's paralyzing. It's really upsetting to know this stuff and not know what to do. So it's not just curriculum stuff. I think that's where the disconnect continues now. I think it's stuff that also happens in friend groups and in families. Like, that's where we see how to live with what we know. That's how we, like, you know, I'm not a hugely extroverted person. Like, I don't love to be in enormous groups all the time. I would say that for me, my most consequential political relationship is one of my closest friendships is with Megan, because it's just having that other person, that sounding board, that way of like developing a view that's bigger than just yourself, and also like, what can we do with what we know? Like, that has to happen in relationship. You have to always be feeling like, am I crazy? And the answer is no. You're like, I see what you're saying. Or like, yeah, maybe walk that back a little bit. I've got a different idea.
Right, because emotion, it's emotional. And that's what happens. Activism is also very emotional. And you have to kind of back off to make it work And that's what we're seeing. Activism has changed. And Megan, you brought up about activism of parents coming home. They're both tired. But isn't activism also about what we can do in our lifestyle changes immediately?
Well, I think it's both, right? So the other sort of dimension on the opposite end of the spectrum from what Josephine was just talking about. So I'm a state senator. I represent a chunk of Providence and half of the city of Pawtucket in Rhode Island. So I'm like,
I'll
you
be
know,
nice about politicians now. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, you go for it, right? And so that's, it's like the very sort of more formalized end of it. And I guess I would say it's all of the above, but one of the challenges of our generation, I think, partly because of when we were raised, is this idea that like consumption defines climate activism, right? So consumption is important. Reducing consumption is important. But I guess I would say like if lifestyle means, you know, trying to talk about how we change institutions, how we change systems, like that I think is a really important lifestyle thing. I also, you know, lifestyle changes that are undertaken in groups, right? Whether those are tool libraries or childcare co-ops or whatever it is, also really important. I think where sometimes the climate movement has bottomed out, it's not even a movement at that point, right? It's just like a bunch of consumer choices. Consumer choices are important, right? They move industries. I'm not saying they're not, but what I am saying is that they're not, those aren't political action. Like a boycott is a political action. Me choosing not to eat beef is not a political action, right? Like, because I'm doing it myself. And so this is where, as you were saying before, like the community connection and the sense making and the sounding boards and all that stuff really comes into play. But I guess I would also say, sort of reflecting on my time in as a legislator and as an elected official, there are a ton of people who are really interested in what's going on and don't have the first idea where to start, right? Like I was, I think, the last generation that got civics classes in high school because they cut it right about the time that I got through there. You know, Rhode Island is a very small state. Everyone in the state lives within an hour of the state house of the Capitol, right? So everybody could come in, testify on a bill, get involved, right? But the skill set, because we've gutted civics education, is, you know, a lot, and it's, you know, it's understandably very scary if you've never done that, and all of those, you know, related issues. So I think there's like, you know, at the very, what is political can look a huge range of ways, ranging from a dyad like Josephine and my extremely political and very close friendship, right? Like, you know, we created this organization, you know, we've been running it for 10 years just on
That's
basis
awesome.
Of that sounding board. And also like, what does it mean to really be in collective groups and how do we build that out?
It just has to go beyond meetings.
And I feel that
about, and don't take this wrong, about politics and about these giant corporations that say they're going to make change. They're going to only make change 10 years from now because they keep meeting. I'm an entrepreneur. I have a meeting and you better get on it now because we don't have time to play meeting. And so I feel like there are too many meetings. Like I'm all for gatherings and community building and I think that's hugely important.
Yeah.
But I also believe you can't just keep meeting and not doing the action. Joan Baez, my favorite quote is, action is the antidote to despair.
Yep.
And just now, we can't be waiting to do action 10 years from now.
100%.
We need to do it now.
Yep.
That's right. Yep. Yeah.
And the first
and
step
I think
that is getting together.
You were asking about the, like, the global versus like the US based view of this stuff. And climate is this super weird issue because it is entirely global and it almost exclusively really manifests in these hyper local ways or like maybe state ways, but like we see different faces of it depending on where we are and we can only address what's right in front of us. There's like, I think that increasingly around this country, and this is true around the world, but this is kind of what we have access to. Wherever you are in this country, you have fossil fuel industry in some shape or form, whether that's just like the sale of and use of fossil fuels, or there's extraction, or there's transport, or there's refining, or whatever.
And in our parks.
Yeah.
And
then we also have like the impacts of the changing climate, which is like where you are, it's really hot, weirdly hot for the time of year. Where I am, torrential downpours, you know, 75 one day, like 22 the next day, that kind of stuff. But like everywhere there's some way that it looks, and it's not consistent across the place, but we all are having this experience of weirdness. So I like the idea that you don't have to go anywhere.
You can't lie about it anymore.
Yeah.
You can't hide.
And you don't have to go anywhere else to see it. You see it where you are. You see the problem where you are, and you see potential solutions where you are.
Being on the road full time, trust me, I'm living through it. Tornadoes, hurricanes, snow, ice storms. I've been through it. My poor car, a blizzard. I talk to her all the time, and it's been going for a long time, but it's real. Crop issues are real. It's affecting our food supply. So when you talk about the conceivable future, it is about food as well. And Megan, I know that you're at an event, you know, she's representing. She's a politician. No, I'm not. You're not. I hate the word politician, but
it's okay. I am a politician.
No, you're not like that. Not one of those. But it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I know you have to sneak out. Josephine will stay here. We'll close up in a little bit. But it has been good to have you on the show. Any closing comments before you go? I feel like we're on CNN now.
Fox News. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And having both of us. Yep. I guess I would say that, you know, Josephine, I think in a few minutes, we'll maybe sort of talk about yeses and nos. We conceive of our activism as bad things we need to stop and good things that we need to build. But none of those things can happen alone. They all have to happen in community. So, you know, we're all children in each other's care in some way. And whether or not, you know, we have children out of our bodies or biologically, you know, we're all responsible for those who come after us. And, you know, that involves building as just and as fair and as healthy a world as possible for everybody. And so thank you for your efforts towards this. And it's been a pleasure talking.
Well, have fun. And you're on an island. We got to take care of you. Take care, Megan. Thank you. So Josephine, I think the most important thing of this conversation and your book is going back to the word community.
Yeah.
It's unity, which means going back to all of it. It is all systems must work for the unity of humankind, which is going to be working for the natural world as well.
Yeah. So I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that I've spent a lot of time thinking about why this issue of all issues is so hard for people to focus in on. And I think that one of the reasons is that there's this scale problem, which is that it's bigger than human scale. It's really hard to we can understand the science, but it's hard to feel in your bones, or take it all in at once. Right. And so that's one of the reasons that the community thing is really important, because I think when you're alone, you can get really, really spun out, really paralyzed by how big the problem seems. Mm-hmm. And especially the way we've talked about it, that it's all about your consumption and you need to reduce your carbon footprint and you need to have fewer children. And you need to do all this stuff to just make less and less. We have this idea that the harms that we can cause are enormous, but the good that we can do is irrelevant, minuscule, right? And it's neither. It's if you're by yourself, the harm and the good that you can do is pretty limited. It's when you start to come together, you get to hold more of the big picture, because you can hold it together and you can kind of take it in that way.
It's like you're either a stream or you're a river, and the river needs all the molecules together to flow, right?
Exactly.
I look at it very, also very difficult, because we're talking about one of the biggest fear factors in the world, which is change.
Yeah.
We're creatures of habit. We are, whether they're good or bad habits, we are creatures of habit. And then we're asking everybody to change something because of a massive change. So it's an immediate, screw you. That's an immediate reaction. And then there's anger, and then there's starting to be this, and now we're dealing with fear, which creates more anxiety and more anger, and then drama, so emotional and hormones and all of this stuff. And if you have a family, it's do we care about soccer practice? Yeah, we do. We do need to keep some of those things going, But I think I was getting to about the lifestyle changes. If families don't feel they can't do anything, you absolutely can. Doesn't mean you have to march down a street. Political action is important because politicians do get away with a ton, and they do walk out with way more money than our healthcare system has. You know, that's the problem. And I think our political system needs, not Megan, she's fine.
Well, but it's an interesting question,
if we don't
because,
knock on that, if we aren't there and calling the White House like we did on our shows, and we did it to teach people. And I'm sorry, but what happened when the White House answered the phone on air, they didn't even know what they were doing. So it was kind of a very weird thing. And I was like, ooh, that's kind of scary. So I think we need to look at, we're so used to barking at the television, barking at anybody who doesn't believe in what we believe in, and not actually communicating and holding accountability and watching. And it's hard. Parents with kids, a single mom with two kids, how are you going to stay on top of everything? Really?
Right. With the help of your friends and your community.
It's the only
ideally,
way.
Right? Yeah.
Right?
I think it's, I like to hear what you're saying about politics, because I think those aren't just like prejudices. That's like many of our experiences. And I think for me, it's been really interesting to collaborate with Megan, because she was not in public office when we met. And she was city council person first, and then she got the Senate seat. And she has also the sort of outsider view that I do, which is activism. One of the forms of activism is pushing on people within power structures to make them make those changes. And now I see that from the inside, if you're a politician, you are enmeshed in the system that is like really inefficient and kind of broken in a lot of ways. But what you're trying to do is get people to push you. You're trying to create this mutuality where you can always demonstrate that there is a public wish, right? Or like, that there are people who are against what you're against, and there's people who are for what you're for. So you're not just acting alone, and you're not just like a tyrant, or that you cannot make.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you need to be in relationship even within and without the halls of power. And so it's a little bit like, how does the sausage get made? And sometimes Megan has like some choice words for like how she spent her day and like what she was listening to or how things were playing out and how
I
many.
Bet. I feel, I mean, the political system is evil. Like, it's mean and it's cruel and it's hard work. And those that are going in there, honestly, are taking a brutal attack. They are.
Well,
like, honestly.
And at the same time, like, there's a real mystification around it that it, I mean, it does involve a lot of money, and that's the biggest problem.
That is the biggest problem. Yeah.
But if you look at who's running for like a lot of like state house seats in a lot of like, there's a lot of uncontested candidates. There's a lot of people who just happen to notice that nobody really wants that job in their state, and they can just kind of put themselves up it with very few credentials and just make something happen. And I think the same is true for like when I had the political awakening that I had when I was living in Olympia, Washington, and I was going to Quaker meetings, and the Quakers have lobby day. I don't know if this is like a universal phenomenon or just the Quakers in Olympia, but they would go to the state house, which was downtown, and they would go office to office and talk about, at the time, gun control was their focal point. I think they do more climate work now. And what I witnessed firsthand, which I had no idea about, is that like a lot of time legislators' doors are wide open and they're waiting for you to tell them stories that they can use as political currency, because stories is the way that they move levers. They have like, I met Joe who did blah, 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 and he wants that kind of thing. So it's a little bit cynical, but it's also, I hope, encouraging that like,
there's a way.
There are ways, even in a broken system, which is the one we find ourselves in, not just politically, but environmentally, economically, there's all this stuff that's not working the way it should. If you take it as a whole and you take it alone, it's quite depressing. It's pretty hard to think you can do anything.
About the Quakers. So that's like an organized community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And historically, I mean, Quakers, have, they were abolitionists, and they ran and helped the Underground Railroad. They did so much as an organized group of people that you may not believe in their spiritual beliefs and religious beliefs, but damn, they've done a lot.
They have, and they were whale traders early days too. So they don't have a perfect environmental record. But
no,
you know.
But here's the balance of that: no one's perfect because we're human beings and we screw up all the time. I don't care what we're talking about; we screw up all the time. That's part. That is. That should be like everyone's resume should start with "I screw up." Yeah, we do. Human beings screw up. So why don't we kind of let each other breathe a little bit, find the ground to work together? Because I don't care. I'm not even a party person. I do. I like my wine. But even us as a magazine, radio, podcast, whatever, all of that, it's like we don't do political ads. We don't do any of that stuff and never will. Because I don't understand how we have that now where a newspaper can see, well, we're voting for this. I'm like, holy cow, that's weird. And I come from a different background and raising. So it's different. And Africa's weird and different on that level too. So we can't really use that as a positive. But why is our media being able to back politicians? And yet all this money is being raised to be put into the coffers of the media, right? That's the big money thing, is so that they have advertising to be voted for. So all of this money that could fix things in our country, it's going to the big media companies. Like, I mean, all of them, the huge media companies are just getting all of the political money. And here we are, little independent people going, we're not doing that. Be honest, have people say what they need to say. We don't even belong to parties. It's like about what's right and what's wrong to us.
Right.
So,
I mean, this is like
that's
a
where
little
I think
bit.
It's community. Like that, I'm going back to the Quakers on that, because they seem to have a community where they all work together to vote together.
Yeah.
So,
I think that I want to go like a little bit left field here, and then I will try and keep it brief. But this is on my mind, which is that, like, I think presently the idea of a political party has a taint because it works so poorly in this country. But in parliamentary systems, the party represents a platform. The platform is not just opinions, but this is what we represent. These are the values that we represent, the policies that we represent. So it matters less who the individual that you're voting for is, but that they will champion the values. So you vote for a party because that party has specific political aims and specific values. And that makes a lot of sense to me. That's an organization, in a way, like the Quakers. It's like, you know, organized around, if you vote for this, we support
That's
this, we don't support that. Right. So we don't do that so well here, but I am interested in, you know, a lot of the grassroots leadership that's coming up, and you see it at the local and at the state level. I'm in Chicago. We have a lot of really progressive local politics that are really inspiring. Many of them are democratic socialists, not all of them, but they're the policy, like the party platform has a really specific meaning. It's not just about like, what are the opinions of the donors? It's like, this is, we are telling you in writing, this is what we stand for. And that actually makes a certain amount of sense to me. I don't feel like blind party loyalty is, I don't think that's what's at work there. I think it's like, we want
these
outcomes. And so we vote this way.
I think we're in this weird changeover. I really believe that. And I think that's part of that, you know, the conceivable future is maybe, you know, I know people who only vote this way because their parents taught them to, and they're now in their 60s and 70s. Like, you know, so maybe we cannot do that with the future. It's about teaching principles and letting your kids. And when I say this, kids, not just like, you know, your immediate kids, your community kids, make choices, decisions, communicate, have these discussions. You know, I think that's really important. And the kids, I mean, kids are so smart compared to when I was a kid. Like, not like that we're dumb, but it was like, We were still playing in the dirt when kids could already understand what Google was doing and a phone that we were like, dude, I'm still playing with this worm. I don't know which is right or wrong, but kids are not dumb. And you can't hide it. I'm glad we brought up that too. You cannot hide it. So,
No, the best thing you
yeah.
can do is help your kid, because you said that you were aware of this stuff as a child. I know that I was, and the fact that when I heard Greta Thunberg start to speak about her own experience of like her climate anxiety, but her parents weren't saying anything or doing anything, that cognitive dissonance, it was so upsetting for me to hear that like 20 years after my own childhood, that there are still young people having that identical experience. And so this idea, like you can't protect your kid from knowing about this, but you can help them feel like you're in it with them, and like you are looking for answers. You will take care to do what's right.
And kids can teach us so much too as older people, right? We can sit back and listen. What's going on? You know, the most important thing we can do is listen. Listen. And just
I think
go,
that's right.
hell, yay, nay. You know, if we can be a listening platform and help. Any closing things? I mean, there's so much with your book and what you guys are doing. We really appreciate your work. But
Thank
yeah, I
you.
mean, there's stuff we can do. There's stuff we shouldn't do, like Megan was saying. I just want to say we can't go around beating a drum and yelling at people and telling them what to do. That's not
That's for
fair.
sure. I think that for us, it's always been conceivable future has always been a lightning rod, because it combines two issues that have always been really touchy in this country, right? Reproduction, reproductive
Conceivable is a good word.
lives. Thank you. I think it's probably the best pun of my life. So you have reproduction, then you have the climate, and those are in certainly when we began our work, those were not either of them like dinner table conversation. But when you look at the climate crisis through the lens of family planning, through the lens of this like intergenerational relationship, and through people's right to reproductive autonomy, you see the crisis really differently. And that's both like the harms that it's already doing to people's reproductive health, to their reproductive freedom, but also the way solutions look different when you foreground a right to a healthy pregnancy, a healthy childhood, and enshrined rights for full spectrum healthcare, for for a life that's as good as
Well,
any, right?
I think it's so huge because what you guys are talking about is like all these systems, right? So people end up eating food that they shouldn't because they can't afford organic food, but then the minimum wage hasn't been raised over in this place. So it's all of these factors, but then the minimum wage also has to be kind to the small business too. So there's all of that. And I feel like our country is being squeezed out by major, major corporations on the political front and on the actual. I just feel like we're going to lose our rights if we don't actually grow up in a way of opening eyes, working together to make real change. Because, you know, we drive through a lot of company towns. And the
I
company
bet.
towns are die. They die out. And so these corporations are doing the same thing as we travel around, and people are not always having the best working conditions,
No,
but
they're
they
not.
think it's okay, and then they're not. But then you end up having habits that are not climate friendly, basically, because of your economics. So I think what's so great about what you guys have done is kind of put all of it together. If we take care of people, we're taking care of the climate.
Well, thanks for saying that. It feels like, I'm glad we had an hour, because it feels like you pull on one thread and you can't help but talk
Oh, you guys
about.
are, that's a bunch of rabbit holes. I
Yeah,
know.
it's that we wrote a bunch of rabbit holes. It is, I think it wasn't obvious to us like what the shape of the book would be until we started writing. And then things fell into place in this order. But it does take you from like the macro to the micro, and then back out to the macro again. And that was sort of thrilling, but we're still in early days of figuring out how to condense that down to like sound bites. So I appreciate you taking the time and really, really talking through it with us.
Yeah, everyone, it's going to be out in February, right? February
February
2024,
6th,
but
that's right.
people can, oh, February 6th, cool. Can people pre-order now, right? They can go
They
there.
sure can. Yeah, if
Go
you go
to
to our website.
conceivablefuture.org is the website. Check that out. I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us and viewers joining us here on Big Blend Radio. And I want to thank Margot Carrera, who's our partner in crime here, for the Nature Connection. She's an amazing nature photographer. And so check her out, and check her out on Etsy, I'm just saying. But anyway, thank you so much, Josephine. And give Megan a hug when you see her, even though she's, you know, on an island in Rhode Island, right?
Thanks so much,
Thanks
Lisa.
So
This was
much.
A pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Nature Connection show. Follow us at bigblendradio.com and keep up with Margot at margotcarrera.etsy.com.